This is superconductivity. Okay. We're going to go through this pretty fast this time because we've already gone through it once. But I think that this sequence is explanatory and helps everybody with it. And I think we've got two screens. Yeah. Okay. This article is from Scientific American. It's called Microclusters. If we could raise it up and read the reference so everybody's got that. It's Scientific American, December 1989. Scientific American. And it says, small aggregates of atoms constitute a distinct phase of matter. Their chemistry, at once highly reactive and selective, has possible applications in catalysis, optics, and electronics. Divide and subdivide a solid, and the traits of its solidity fade away one by one like the features of the Cheshire Cat, to be replaced by characteristics that are not those of liquids or gases. They belong instead to a new phase of matter, the microcluster. Microclusters consist of tiny aggregates comprising from two to several hundred atoms. They pose questions that lie at the heart of solid-state physics and chemistry and the related field of material science. How small must an aggregate of particles become before the character of the substance they once formed is lost? And how might the atoms reconfigure themselves if freed from the influence of matter that surrounds them? Now, this is the key sentence here, people. How might the atoms reconfigure themselves if freed from the influence of the matter that surrounds them? Now, most of us were taught that an atom is an atom. And if it's in a metal, it has nearest neighbors, and if it's by itself, it's naked. But it still is the atom. Well, in fact, that isn't true. There are atoms that when you free them from the nearest neighbors, they actually reconfigure themselves. They change their nature. They are not the same atom they were before. Okay, let's go to the next slide. This is a reference from Solid State Physics and the Liquid State by the Xerox Research Facility. And this actually talks about nonmetals, a glass transition. It says, a prerequisite for glass formation is the prevention of nucleation and crystal growth as the liquid is cooled below its melting or freezing point. So a prerequisite for a glass to form is that it not develop any crystalline structure with itself. The atoms not rearrange themselves. So that's the reason when you get to the monoatomic state, it totally does not look like a metal anymore. This white powder looks like baking flour. Okay, it looks like cooking flour. It's snow white, very talky, and doesn't at all look like it's a metal. Let's go to the next reference. This is from the same book, and what they're talking about is they're flat cooling metals. And if you melt a metal goes totally amorphous, and then you slam that molten metal against a super cool plate, and you take the energy out of it so fast that it doesn't have time to crystallize. And if you can actually get the energy in the metal below its crystallization point, then it can't crystallize anymore. You've got it below that energy that it takes to crystallize. Now it's in a glassy state. Anyway, the sentence in here that's really important is, as the temperature decreases below the melting temperature, the critical radius also decreases, and at the temperature equal to the melting temperature, the critical radius goes to infinity. In other words, you melt it, it's just totally amorphous. It has no structure at all. But the next sentence is the key. In the range of temperatures where potential nuclei actually grow, the critical radius is usually about 10 atomic diameters. So here's a reference for it right here in a published text. If you have 10 atomic diameters or larger, it will aggregate to itself and grow metal. If the atoms are in 10 atomic diameters or less, they repulse each other. They will not come together, and you don't get metal. Now, that's just a general number, the 10. In fact, when you find out that for iridium, for instance, it's 9 atom clusters, anything larger than 9 grows. Anything less than 9 comes apart. For platinum and rhodium, it's 5 atom clusters. Anything 5 or larger comes together. Anything 5 or less then comes apart. For gold, it's diatomic. Diatomic or larger is metallic and grows. If it's monoatomic, it doesn't grow. So as you can see, gold's the toughest one. It's the one that fights you all the way down to the monoatomic stage. It doesn't help you one bit. No slack granted here. Iridium, all you got to do is get it below 9 and just heat it, cool it, and it comes apart all on its own. Okay? Now, it's real interesting. When the man from Engelhard Industry evaluated our work, He said, gosh, this explains so many things we can't understand. At Engelhart, when we actually bring iridium scrap back to our factory from the jewelry industry and we try re-refining the iridium, we cannot guarantee over an 86% recovery on the iridium. 14% is lost in the processing. Yet when we get gold, we get 99.9% recovery on it. Well, the reason is you will never disaggregate gold to the monatomic state in any normal processing. And so it always recovers, 100%. But iridium, when you get below 9-atom clusters, it comes all apart. And so in the dissolution of the iridium, much of it does happen to get below 9-atom clusters. And so they lose 14%. And he says, gosh, that explains why we can't process iridium well. By platinum and rhodium, we get about 97% recovery. With gold, we get 100% virtually. And that's why. It isn't lost in the processing. So what they're doing is they're dumping 14% of their iridium down the drain. They don't know where it went. It's still in solution. It won't come back. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Then one other reference that I think is real important, and for these people interested in the physics, we need to get right down to the bottom of it. The last sentence here. For many molecular and polymeric glasses, the glass transition temperature less absolute zero temperature is only about 40 to 60 degrees Kelvin. In other words, absolute zero, no temperature at all, there's only about 40 degrees Kelvin between absolute zero and the temperature of the glass. So what they're saying is the glass is cold, that the internal temperature of the glass is very, very cold. And you don't have to take that much temperature out of it before it's absolute zero. Okay? It's real important to understand that the internal temperature of the atom has nothing to do with the outside temperature. That even though it's sitting here at room temperature, 350 or 360 degrees Kelvin, that has nothing to do with the internal temperature of the atom. The atom's totally a world all its own. Let's go to the last slide here. Here is a reference when you understand that, in fact, in a metal, the temperature, depending on the metal, is somewhere between 350 and 375 degrees Kelvin. Pretty darn hot in a metal. When you disaggregate the metal to smaller and smaller cluster size, in fact, you are lowering the internal bound temperature of the system. There actually are researchers over in Italy who actually measure the phonon frequency of energy being shared between the nucleus and the electron, and they find that wavelength gets longer and longer and longer, the smaller and smaller the particle size becomes. And actually, they actually, here are specific examples. Here is potassium, which is K2, diatomic potassium, and its internal temperature is about 90 to 100 degrees at 10 millibars pressure. But at 1 millibar pressure, it's about 110 degrees. The trimer of sodium is about 100 degrees, and the dimer of sodium is about 40 to 50 degrees. So as you can see, the trimer is hotter than the dimer. From there to there. Well, they can't find the monomer, but it should be somewhere down in here, approaching absolute zero. But they can't find it to measure. They don't know how to see it. They try to find it, and they can't find it. Well, the problem is they really can't produce it readily. So as you disaggregate the metal by chemistry, you're actually cooling the metal down. Okay, this is an article out of Scientific American, March 1990. It's called New Radioactivities. Now, I'm going to say this again, like I said before. I'm not trying to teach you nuclear physics, people. What I want you to see is the date. I want you to see who published it. I want you to see the credentials. And we will read a few excerpts out of it. But I'm not trying to teach you nuclear physics, because this isn't what this is about. This is about seeing as a confirmation of when we filed our patent and what's going on. This article called New Radioactivities is all about studying the nucleus. And here they have these harmonic sequences of protons and neutrons depicted like kind of like a bullseye. They found out that the protons and neutrons fill in the nucleus just like the electrons fill. You remember the electron orbitals they taught you in chemistry class? There's 2, 8, 8, 16. There's actually harmonic sequences. It goes 1, 2, and then that one's filled, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, then that one's filled, starts the next one. Well, the nucleus fills in the same way. The protons and neutrons are actually quantum oscillators, and they fill in harmonic sequences. So they fill Same note, occupier. Same note, occupier. They fill in harmonic sequences. And they depict these here as little rings. So you got it here, you got it here, you got it here. This fills coming out. Okay? That's what this is depicting, is proton and neutron configuration. Let's go to the next slide. Now, this is the left-hand side of the page. This other page is the right-hand side. And here, what we're depicting is the uranium-232. Its proton and neutron orbitals begin to deform. Then it becomes severely deformed, and then it pops apart into neon-24 and lead-208, two different elements. Now, when this was first observed by the nuclear physicists who are capable of working with a single atom, there was no alpha, no beta, and no gamma emission. And this was not the nuclear physics they expected to see. Anytime you get fission, there is also always alpha, beta, or gamma emission. One, sometimes a combination. But when this happened, there was no alpha, beta, or gamma emission. And the nuclear physicist said, whoa, what happened here? It was uranium-232, now it's lead and neon. Where'd it come from? How'd it happen? Is this the way it's supposed to be? So anyway, what we need to read here is basically, this is really critical to this whole understanding, is this basic information here. It is now known that the atomic nucleus is a more or less spherical object whose diameter is about a few fermis, or a unit of measure equal to 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter, or simply 10^-15 meters. In other words, it's very, 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 very tiny. For comparison, the radius of the moon's orbit is only about 30 times greater than the diameter of the Earth. So what they're trying to show you is, you know, here's the Earth and here's the moon, and here's the itty-bitty nucleus and a huge electron cloud around it. It's nowhere near the size of this nucleus. The electron cloud is immense compared to the size of this tiny little nucleus. It says, packed in this Fermi-sized nucleus is nearly all the mass of an atom and all its positive electric charge. The mass of the nucleus comes mainly from nucleons, and protons carry the positive charge. Okay, no big deal. It's what we were taught in school. The structure of the nucleus arises from two types of interreactions, the strong and the electromagnetic. And as a result of the strong interreaction of the nuclear force, protons bind to neutrons and to each other. So this is the glue. The strong force, the glue. The nuclear force binds nucleons very tightly but acts over a very short range. To separate two neutrons that are one Fermi apart, for instance, requires an energy of about 1,000,000 electron volts. Now, everything so far is exactly the way we were taught in school. No problems. Everything just the way we were taught. But it says, on the other hand, only about 10 electron volts is needed to disassociate two nucleons that are 10 Fermis apart. Now, this is where the situation changes, people. It only takes 10 electron volts to cause these nuclear particles to come apart if they're deformed. Now, as a result of the electromagnetic interreaction, or the Coulomb force, protons repel other protons. Although the Coulomb force is weaker than the nuclear force, it acts over a much longer range. So if two protons are one Fermi apart, the Coulomb force is about 100 times weaker than the nuclear force. Yet at a distance of 10 Fermis, the Coulomb force is about 10 times stronger than the nuclear force. So what this is saying is that little weak force isn't very strong, the one that tries to push the nucleons apart, until it gets a little bit deformed. And when it gets the least little bit deformed, the glue quits working. And then the force that's trying to push them apart blows them apart. It didn't say it needed any help at all. It says it blows itself apart. Now, this isn't the world we were taught in school. The nucleus is supposed to be a very stable thing. It takes millions of electron volts to rip it apart, and here we're talking about one coming apart all on its own. Sounds like alchemy. Let's go to the next one. Anyway, that's the basis of what we're talking about, people. Now, here's the periodic table. Now, this is the Mendeleev periodic table, the standard chemistry periodic table. And basically what it says is over here, these nuclei are very stable, and what it says over here is these nuclei are very stable. What they first found is, starting here with actinium, number 89, Then it goes 90, 91, 92, 93, 94. These are all the heavy elements called the actinide group, named after actinium. These are the heavy ones. And these nuclear physicists found that every one of these elements, actinium, thorium, protactium, uranium, neptunium, plutonium, americium, every one of these would just deform and blow apart if they were monoatomic. They say, well, why didn't they discover this sooner? Well, nobody ever looked at it that well before. They found out they just come apart. They actually become deformed just like their radioactive isotope come apart. Well, most of these are radioactive isotopes. So you say, well, it's no big deal then, Dave. They're just coming apart, but this is what we'd expect. It's no big deal. But no sooner did they find that the actinide group here would do it, all these heavy elements, than they began to look at the lanthanide group, which is number 57. And they found that 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 60, if you move them up and stick them in the periodic table, they should go right here. Okay, that's where they should be. But they took them out, and they moved them down here, and then they shoved the next row up. So it's kind of missing out of the periodic table, because they're called the rare earths. And they say, you're never going to find these that much. You don't have to worry. That's why you don't need to worry about this. They're just the rare earths. Well, they're not that rare. They found out since then they're not that rare. But anyway, when they began to look at this group of elements, they found that when they begin with the lanthanide group, the beginning here was 62, samarium, europium, gadolinium, terbium, and dysprosium. So 62 through 66, this group right here all would do this. They literally deform and blow themselves apart all on their own. Or they're capable of blowing themselves apart, but they deform. And they say, well, golly, 62 through 66, those are not that heavy an element. They're right here in the middle of the periodic table. And they blow apart. And so they said, gee, if this will do it, and it's based on the harmonic sequence in the nucleus, that over here the nucleus are just starting to fill their outer orbitals, and here they're just completing filling their outer orbitals, but if these elements right here in the center of the periodic table where the problem is, because they have half-filled or half-empty nuclear orbitals. So they're the most unfilled or the most out of balance that any system could be. It's like having a big glob of mud on one of the tires in your car. It'll go whomp, whomp, whomp as you try to drive it down the road. You gotta get out and wash that mud off because it'll just deform itself. It'll shake the tire off your car. Anyway, if you take this group, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, and you move it up and you stick it in the periodic table right here where it belongs, it goes 58, 59, 60, 61, 62. So here's where 62 should be, 63, 64, 65, and 66. So they said, well, gee, if these elements do that, then these elements here, ruthenium, rhodium, palladium, silver, and cadmium, and osmium, iridium, platinum, gold, and mercury should also do the same thing. That's the thinking. If the rare earths do it, then the ones immediately blow and really blow should also do the same thing. That's the theory. So let's go to the next paper.